rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism. Sanctions and terrorism are the main pillars of the American version of human rights. If they are robbed of these two pillars, they may not be able to continue their dominance and plots.
Analysts believe that the unilateral U.S. sanctions are a means of collective punishment of all people, without any exception.
Here in Iran, people believe that the title American Human Rights Week seeks to condemn Washington's double standard policies with regard to human rights and reveal this very reality to the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Protesters blocking lanes and taking part in slowdowns on busy roads across the UK.
Give us our country back!
Organized on social media by Fuel Price Stand Against Tax, they're demanding deeper cuts in fuel duty. Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced a 5 pence cut in March, but that has not meant much at the forecourts.
Fuel prices in the UK have hit record highs since the beginning of the year. Only a few months ago, it would have cost roughly $90 to fill up, let's say, a 50-litre tank. But now it'll cost $30 more to fill up that same tank.
And that has put the squeeze on the finances of people. Some have had to quit their jobs because they couldn't afford the commute anymore. Businesses, too, are feeling the pinch at the pump and are passing the extra costs onto the consumers, worsening the cost of living crisis.
Worst of all, the poorest are suffering the most. You can't just switch off your power, you can't switch off your car, you can't switch off your central heating. And when winter comes, people will freeze. All of that, a direct consequence of this government's failure to have a joined-up energy policy, and we are literally paying the consequences.
Among the biggest factors contributing to the fuel price hikes, the UK's green energy policy and Western sanctions on Russian energy exports in the wake of the Ukraine war. Sanctions that the UK government was among the first to impose.
The sanctions imposed upon Russia for political reasons have clearly pushed up the energy costs. But secondly, and even more importantly, Britain has an idiotic environmental policy where they import the very fossil fuels that they depend on, even though under our feet there are £1 trillion worth of gas, and in the North Sea there are billions of pounds worth of oil.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has hinted at a rise in UK oil and gas output, but critics say it would have little effect on consumer bills. And as long as the UK, along with its Western allies, fans the flames of the war in Ukraine, scenes like this may well become more frequent. Saeed Purza, London.
Thousands of Iranian pilgrims have arrived in the holy city of Mecca for the Hajj pilgrimage. This once-in-a-lifetime journey requires spiritual as well as physical preparation. It's an arduous trip, and pilgrims usually start exercising prior to traveling to Mecca to enhance their fitness levels. However, what if pilgrims got sick or had an injury? To make sure Iranian pilgrims will receive proper and quick medical services during their Hajj pilgrimage, the Islamic Republic's Red Crescent Society has taken special measures. First, all Iranian pilgrims have checkups in the country to make sure they are healthy and in good physical condition. After receiving medical approval to travel to Saudi Arabia, each Hajj caravan is accompanied by a doctor.
Our goal is to bring back all Iranian pilgrims to our country in perfect health. We assure our pilgrims that during their journey, a medical team accompanies them, and in case of any problems, they will receive the required services.
Doctors accompany pilgrims in their hotels and provide outpatient services for them.
Three medical clinics operate 24/7. In addition, a well-equipped hospital in the city of Mecca is currently providing specialized services to Iranian pilgrims.
While so far there have been no cases of serious illnesses or injuries, Iranian doctors ask pilgrims to look after their health.
Older persons or those with underlying diseases should avoid going out in the hottest part of the day and rather go out at times when outdoor air temperatures are cooler.
Pilgrims should also be cautious about getting infectious diseases. and wear masks in gatherings and crowded places. Iran's medical team sent to Saudi Arabia has carried the title of the best team for several years, and the key to their success is the devotion and love of the medical staff.
God has blessed us with the opportunity to be here with a group of our friends. We enjoy the spiritual environment of Hajj and serve the pilgrims of Kaaba.
Serving the pilgrims of Kaaba is one of the biggest blessings that has been bestowed upon me in my life. It has been one of my biggest dreams. I hope to be a good servant for Hajj pilgrims.
Providing different services for Iranian Hajj pilgrims is not only a duty, but rather an honor. Mahdi Abbasian, Mecca.
Highlighting the United States' rights violations at the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which the Islamic Republic calls the Den of Espionage. Every year in late June and early July, Iranian activists get together to commemorate the American Human Rights Week to recount instances of U.S. rights abuses in Iran.
United States, who is, you know, shouting the human right, we think that this is just a, you know, slogan without any background. And because when it's go to the Iranian people, we think we have seen that these people have been targeted, and we do not receive any apology about that.
The week-long occasion marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Rights activists say in all of those instances, the footprints of the U.S. can be traced. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board the doomed plane. More than three decades on, and Iran is still waiting for an apology from Washington. Rights activists believe the U.S. has not abandoned its double standards regarding human rights.
We know that more than 30 countries have received the negative sanctions from the United States. Sanction is something that violates the human rights, the right of the development, right of the education, right of the health.
The American Human Rights Week also marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mojahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast. The Islamic Republic says the MKO is responsible for killing 12,000 Iranians in different terror attacks. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been taking part in the terror group's annual summits in Paris.
They have withdrawn the MKO from the blacklist, and this withdrawal paved the way for the Americans, not only for the Americans, but also for the MKO, to extend their own terrorist operations through the facilities that they are provided from the Americans and also from the European territories.
The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls on the same period in the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Activists here say Washington has shrugged off its crimes in Iran, and that's why they observe the American Human Rights Week every year to take a jab at the U.S. for its selective approach toward human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alina Lip, a German journalist who has been reporting from the pro-Russian Donbass region of Ukraine for over 6 months. She recently received charges from the German legal system threatening her with 3 years in jail.
On 24th of February, I shared on my Telegram channel the news that Ukraine is killing civilians already for 8 years. And I also said that this is a genocide and that people here in Donbass support the special operation of Russia. And this is a criminal act for Germany.
But Ukraine has been killing civilians here for 8 years. That's just
controversial. That's a fact. I'm filming here for half a year now, and I'm living in Donetsk, and I'm hearing all the day this shelling around me, and this is not Russia.
And the other one, it says there is that you said that most people here support the separatists. That's a fact as well.
That's a fact, yeah, of course.
A few days after Alina's charge sheet was issued, the main German TV channel ARD ran a story reporting that the Russian army was bombing Donetsk, but then it was the Ukrainian army. The next day, the channel published a retraction and apology. It's not clear how many people who saw the report also saw the retraction.
The courts have also taken €1,600 out of Alina's bank account, money given to her by members of the public who are appreciative of her work. They also say that she is not allowed to defend herself at a hearing. Now, I've read the document, and the only conclusion I can draw from it is that either the German courts are trying to prosecute honest journalists, or that, frankly, they don't have even the most basic grasp of international politics. I'm not sure which one is more damaging to the credibility of the German legal system.
They just want to put me in prison for 3 years, but not hear me out. I mean, what... It's unbelievable. And especially they open this case because I'm sharing my opinion. So there's no free speech anymore in Germany.
Luis Cervera, an independent Spanish-Russian journalist who has been reporting on the suffering of the Donbass people at the hands of the Ukrainian army.
At first, I received a lot of hate comments, hate in general. Then I received also harassment from different people pursued me. They published my phone number or my private information. They even published an address of a flat where I used to live.
While Julian Assange faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in jail, he is not the only journalist under threat of imprisonment for telling the truth. Alina, like many other independent journalists, have been deplatformed from some social media outlets and has had her PayPal account suspended. Anti-war sites Consortium News and Mint Press have also had their PayPal accounts suspended in an attempt to cut off funding.
The job of a journalist is to uncover stories so that society can debate and implement policy based on their findings. Now, while mainstream outlets don't even send reporters to this part of Ukraine, the few Western reporters who are here risk their lives and their reputations to uncover important truths. For that, they risk being deplatformed, smeared, or sent to jail simply for doing their job. There's increasingly a worrying campaign by tech companies, governments, and courts to strangle anti-war dissent in the West. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Coming up is the Hajj message by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, the Prophet Muhammad, upon his pure progeny, and upon his chosen companions. Praise God, the Almighty and the Wise, for once again having made the blessed month of Dhu'l-Hijjah a meeting place for the Muslim nations, and for having made this path of his grace and mercy available to them. The Islamic nation can once again observe its unity and harmony in this clear, timeless mirror, and take this opportunity to turn away from the factors that lead to disunity and division. The unity of the Muslim nation is one of the two basic foundations of the Hajj pilgrimage. When combined with spirituality and the remembrance of God, which comprises the other basic foundation of this religious duty that is so full of secrets, they can lead the Islamic nation to the heights of honor and bliss. They can enable the nation to become an example of the verse, "All might belongs to Allah and His Messenger and the believers." Hajj is a combination of these two political and spiritual elements, and the sacred religion of Islam is a glorious, majestic fusion of the political and spiritual spheres. In recent history, the enemies of Muslim nations have undertaken an extensive drive to weaken the two life-giving elixirs of Islamic unity and spirituality among our nations. The enemies of Islam strive to weaken spirituality by promoting a Western lifestyle that is devoid of spirituality and which is rooted in a short-sighted, materialistic vision of the world. They strive to undermine Islamic unity by promoting and promulgating baseless factors that sow division, such as differences in language, color, race, and geography. The Islamic nation, a small portion of which can now be seen in the symbolic ritual of Hajj, must rise up against this with every ounce of its being. This means, on the one hand, we must increase remembrance of God, working for God, contemplating the words of God, and our trust in God's promises in all of our minds. And, on the other hand, everyone must work to overcome factors that create division and disunity. What can be said with certainty today is that the current situation of the world and of the Islamic world is more prepared for this valuable effort than ever before. First reason is that the elites and much of the general population in Islamic countries are now aware of the great wealth of the religious understanding and spiritual heritage and of its significance and value. Today, liberalism and communism, the most significant contributions of Western civilization, no longer have the same appeal that they did 100 or 50 years ago. The credibility of capital-driven Western democracy is being seriously questioned, and Western thinkers admit that they are at a theoretical and practical loss. By observing this situation, young people, intellectuals, scientists, and religious scholars within the world of Islam are able to gain new perspectives on the wealth and value of their own knowledge, as well as on the mainstream political currents in their own countries. This is the Islamic awakening that we continually refer to. Secondly, this Islamic self-awareness has created a wondrous, miraculous phenomenon in the very heart of the Islamic world, and this poses serious problems for the arrogant powers. The name of this phenomenon is resistance, and its reality is manifested in the power of faith, struggling on the path of God and relying on Him. This is the same phenomenon about which the following noble verse was revealed in the formative period of Islam. Those to whom the people said, "All the people have gathered against you, so fear them." That only increased them in faith, and they said, "Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee." So they returned with Allah's blessing and grace, untouched by any harm. They pursued the pleasure of Allah, and Allah is dispenser of a great grace. The situation in Palestine is one of the manifestations of this amazing phenomenon that has been able to bring down the rebellious Zionist regime from its state of aggression and howling to a defensive, passive stance and impose on it the current obvious array of political, security, and economic problems. Other brilliant examples of Islamic resistance can be clearly seen in Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, and some other places. Thirdly, in addition to these other factors, the world is currently witnessing to a successful and proud model of power and political Islamic governance in Islamic Iran. The stability, independence, progress, and honor of the Islamic Republic is a great, meaningful phenomenon that can attract the thoughts and feelings of every conscious Muslim. The inabilities and at times mistaken actions of the officials of this system, mistakes which have postponed the attainment of all the blessings of Islamic governance, have never been able to shake the solid foundations or to stop the firm steps that have been taken in the path of the material and spiritual progress of the Islamic Republic, as these are inspired by the basic principles of this system. The following factors are to be found at the top of the list of these basic principles: the sovereignty of Islam in the legislative and executive branches of governance, reliance on the vote of the people in the country's most important administrative matters, complete political independence, and a refusal to rely on any oppressive powers. These principles can be the basis for a consensus between Muslim nations and governments, and they have the potential to bring unity and harmony to the Islamic nation in its direction and cooperation. These are the principles and factors that have fostered favorable conditions in the Islamic world for harmonious, unified movement. More than anyone else, Muslim governments, religious and scientific elites, independently minded intellectuals, and the truth-seeking youth should think about taking full advantage of these favorable conditions. It is natural for the arrogant powers and the United States, more than anyone else, to be worried about such a trend in the Islamic world, and for them to employ all their resources in order to confront it. And this is what we are observing. The tactics they employ range from dominating the media and soft warfare to warmongering and starting proxy wars, political espionage and acts of inducement, intimidation, bribing, and other forms of enticement. Each and every one of these tactics is employed by the United States and other arrogant powers to separate the Islamic world from its rightful path of awakening and felicity. The criminal, disgraceful Zionist regime in this region is yet another tool that they use for this all-out effort. These efforts have failed in most cases, thanks to God's grace and His will, and the arrogant West has become weaker by the day in our sensitive region and, more recently, throughout the whole world. The distress and the failure of the United States and its criminal accomplice, the usurper Zionist regime in the region, can clearly be seen in the recent events of Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Afghanistan. On the other hand, the Islamic world is brimming with motivated, energetic young people. Hope and self-confidence are the greatest assets for building the future. Today, these assets are abundant in the Islamic world, especially in this region. We all have a duty to protect and increase these precious assets. However, we should not neglect the enemy's stratagems for a single moment. Let us avoid pride and negligence, and let us increase our alertness and efforts. And at all times, let us attentively beseech the Almighty, wise God, for His help. Participating in Hajj and its rituals provides a great opportunity for relying on God and beseeching Him, as well as for deliberation and decision-making. Pray for your Muslim brothers and sisters around the world and ask for their success and victory. Please ask for divine guidance and help for this brother of yours in your pure prayers. May God's peace and mercy be upon you. Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Dua al-Hajjah, 5-14-43, July 5, 2022.
What you just heard was the Hajj message by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Might as well be called a political bloodbath. More than 30 ministers have quit Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government. Yet the British Prime Minister rejects calls by the Labour opposition, for example, to call a snap general election. But why are his ministers quitting en masse? Why did they lose such faith in his leadership? Were too many scandals just too much to bear? Or do they believe that Johnson is just not fit to run a country which is going through an economic crisis? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight.
What was meant to be a routine weekly gathering of cabinet ministers morphed into something very different. Double mortal blows to the Prime Minister Boris Johnson as his Health Secretary Sajid Javid and Chancellor Rishi Sunak quit their jobs within minutes of each other, handing in resignation letters that make for extraordinary reading. The vote of confidence last month, Sajid Javid wrote, was a moment for humility, grip, and new direction. I regret to say, however, that it is clear to me that the situation will not change under your leadership, and you have therefore lost my confidence too. The Chancellor also took aim at the PM's character. The public, he wrote, rightly expect government to be conducted properly, competently, and seriously.
Nothing's worse for a party than a loss of faith in the character of their leader. And these senior politicians, and let's recognise over a dozen of them have now resigned, are saying it's either Boris Johnson or us. Since Boris Johnson isn't going, they are. They're going to have to sit it out, like Boris, but there can only be one winner, and it won't be the Prime Minister.
Boris Johnson's is a government embroiled in sleaze and scandal for months, from lockdown rules-breaching parties under his roof to porn-watching MP. The latest controversy emerged over this man, Chris Pincher, forced to resign from government over accusations of sexual harassment. But the last straw was when it turned out that despite Number 10's denials, the Prime Minister knew of a past formal complaint against Pincher all along. He appointed him to his cabinet.
I apologize for it. I think in hindsight it was the wrong thing to do. I apologize to everybody who's been badly affected by it.
But that didn't wash with the now former Chancellor and Health Secretary or the dozens of MPs who have already resigned. More defections could be on the way.
There's no doubt that we will see more resignations, with quite a few cabinet ministers not declaring one way or the other. But the realpolitik here is he's lost the confidence of his party. He's lost the confidence of a very large number of people whom he himself appointed, and the public aren't taking him seriously. I like Boris as a friend. I think he's a decent man. But the one thing he doesn't seem to have is good judgment about when to leave.
Whether or not Boris Johnson can survive politically is a question debated by his friends and foes for months. The question now is whether these recent resignations will be the beginning of the end for a prime minister whose leadership is in free fall and as the specter of a new no-confidence vote looms large. Saipur is up, London.
Well, let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Trevor Busby joins us. He's an economic analyst who joins us from London. Also joining us is Mick Napier, activist and commentator who joins us from Edinburgh. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me first start with you, Shabir Rezvi, if I may. We're looking at the reasons behind these mass resignations that have taken place, of rocking the government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson. And of course, as you're well aware, it's the Pincher affair, this Chris Pincher, the deputy chief whip who resigned last week. Do you buy the fact that that is the only reason that you're seeing all these resignations?
Hello, good evening. I'm sitting not very far from the parliament at this moment, about 20 minutes away. And really, it's an extraordinary situation that's unfolding here in the last 24 hours. I think really, one's got to look at it in context. It's not that what happened with the Deputy Chief Whip, Mr. Pincher, or the sort of catalogue of Mr. Johnson has been well known to have very little affinity with truth. Historically, when he was the mayor of London or throughout his premiership or prior to it, when he sold the lie of Brexit. One of the MPs recently described in the last 24 hours that they are demoralized, distraught and disturbed, distressed. I would say that the government has been dodgy, disgraceful and really disreputable. It's that, you know, the two ministers resigning, and over the last 24 hours, we've had about 38 ministers and sort of ministers or secretaries of state who have resigned. Not only that, what's fascinating is that his newly appointed chancellor, Nadeem Zahawi, is also lobbying for the prime minister to resign. It's really quite disgraceful. You know, the whole politics in UK, I think we did a commentary about 4 or 5 months ago where I said that the Conservative Party is a winning machine. They really don't care who the leader is, so long as they are in a position to win. So I think the MPs are now realizing, the Conservative MPs are very clearly realizing that to have Boris Johnson as Prime Minister is probably more dangerous for their own well-being as members of parliament. So they're abandoning ship at this moment, and also the former ministers are also looking whether they can also become prime ministers when Johnson goes. I mean, there's a great metaphor in English which says a fish rots from the head down. So obviously it has been rotting for the last 2.5 years, if you like, since Boris Johnson became the prime minister, and it is very clearly becoming that the fish is smelling terribly now, and they have to either get rid of that fish or do something else altogether. And this is where the whole situation arises. As you said in your opening comments, that we've got a crisis taking place where ordinary families are suffering in UK. Nearly 4 to 5 million people go to food banks, and you know, fuel prices up, energy prices up, and the reality is that these shenanigans taking place at Westminster do not impact the people when they're suffering economic pain.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mick Napier, it's really turning out to be a soap opera here, if you really take a look at it in some sense, which is not funny, really. But when you have a chancellor that Johnson elects, and then that chancellor turns against Johnson, what are we looking at here? Are we looking? I mean, there's got to be something bigger picture here that maybe we're not catching on to, in terms of the revolt that's taking place. Especially when you have a new chancellor that then turns on the PM. How do you assess the situation?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's a soap opera, but if somebody had written the script for a soap opera, it would have been rejected by the director as far, far too improbable. A couple of hours ago, there were 20 ministers and junior ministers who had resigned from the government. Now I think it's just one or two under 40. It's 38 or 39 now. So this is unprecedented. We've never seen anything like this in British politics. I think we need to look at the surface and then look a little bit beneath the surface. I mean, at one level, most of the crisis can be deflected. That is, an intelligent and a different kind of leader could have avoided them. You know, the promotion of a sex pest, really, what can I say, shocking and horrifying millions of British people who had been unable to say goodbye to their loved ones when they were dying during lockdown because the lockdown was extremely strict. And during this time, Johnson and his friends were ordering people on TV to follow these instructions and then leaving to have a drunken alcohol-fueled party, violating all the rules. That got through to a lot of people at a very visceral level. And I think we're seeing some of the effects of that coming through in the crisis today. You know, all sorts of dishonesty and shenanigans from Johnson. But you know, who could be surprised? He has a whole history of dishonesty, of being fired from jobs, of being caught on television, of being caught in a phone call, plotting violence against a journalist whom one of his friends was angry at. But I think we do have to go a little bit deeper, because I think most of the Tory MPs are very worried about losing their seats. There are many crimes that they consider Johnson has committed, but they all come under one heading. They could lose their seats. And his only real crime for them is losing elections. And he's losing elections by an unprecedented margin, and they're worried about their seats. But it's not just that. I think we look at some of the key spokesmen for the Conservative Party, and you can see that they're very worried. They're using language against their own leader, which we've never heard before. And I think we have to look at not just losing seats, but the crises that are coming down the road for any government in London. Sure. Inflation, strikes, they're preparing for a long drawn out war, a proxy war against Russia. And they feel entering all these crises of a perfect storm that they need a leader whom they can rely on, whom they can trust, and somebody who will inspire confidence among the population.
Sure.
And Johnson can't do that. So I think taking those two things together, that goes a long way to explaining this soap opera.
We're going to get into some of those issues that you just talked about, really. But this is what Johnson has said so far in terms of the way that he has treated this, Shabir Rizvi, and he has said that he has a mandate from the 2019 election to press on. I'm not going to step down. And that's the last thing that this country needs, frankly, is an election. Is it the last thing the country needs, or is it what the country needs?
Sorry, is that for me?
Yes, for you, yes.
Okay, thank you. Look, insofar as elections are concerned, obviously the Labour Party is jockeying to have an election as soon as possible. Whether that happens or not, because within the sort of parliamentary process that we have in UK is that a leader can be removed and another leader from the same party can be installed, and he can continue until the next election, which is due perhaps just over 2 years from now. So that's an option that the Conservative Party may want to take, because as our commentator earlier said, that the members of parliament, the 80 majority that the Conservative Party have, potentially a lot of them could lose their seats. So they may want to continue, because as I said, the ethos of the Conservative Party is not ethics, honesty, and all the nice words that Mr. Sunak and Mr. Sajid Javid have used. The reality of the Conservative Party is it's a winning machine. It wants to be in power so that its friends in the city can benefit and the ordinary people become losers. That's the sort of ethos of the Conservative Party. So they will abandon any leader. As I have commented previously, that Margaret Thatcher, who won 3 elections for the Conservative Party over 30 years ago, she was knifed and she was removed while she was prime minister. And similar thing happened to Theresa May. Soon after that, Boris Johnson became the prime minister because she had a very thin majority to carry on after the election that she called. So the reality is that the Conservative Party may want to put a new face to it, but the tragedy is that in the UK, the Conservative Party has taken the garb of the right-wing elements in society who are, in a way, very keen for Britain to stay out of the European Union. They're against immigration and the whole host of racist policies that right-wing parties had. And the Conservative Party has taken that on, which appeals to a significant section of the population in UK. Therefore, if there is an election tomorrow, potentially with a new head of the Conservative Party, the Conservative may potentially win election again, because they're very good at winning elections. The Labour Party doesn't have a leader that can really resonate with the public at this moment. So I don't know whether Labour will win if there's an election, but the reality is that the Conservative Party is willing to abandon a leader as and when required, so long as they can continue to be in power.
Sure. Well, I don't know if this is important or not, but it is, in a sense, where we're looking at another, what are we looking at here? The UK Minister for Industry, Lee Rowley, and four other members of the government have resigned. I don't know if you were aware of that. So, Mick Knapp here. Let's go to the election, the 1922 Executive Committee. They're looking for the rules to change in terms of the vote of confidence, of which, as it stands, it cannot be challenged for another year, and it seems like they will be able to do that. So what direction will this now be taken in terms of how it will affect whether the vote of confidence is going to take place, and in what period of time?
That's a very good question. I mean, it's quite useful to look at Boris Johnson as a kind of mini Donald Trump. But the problem for Johnson is that we don't, as our other guest has said, we don't have a presidential system. It's a parliamentary system. And the system now, I think, means that very shortly, Boris Johnson will go. He has a huge majority of his party against him or indifferent. His recently appointed chancellor has just come in the door and has turned on him, taken a political knife out of his pocket, and told him that Johnson has to go, which brings Nadeem Zahawi very close to replacing him because he's currently the chancellor. So I think it's impossible for the government to proceed. I mean, how on earth? I mean, you've just mentioned that an extra four people have left. It is impossible for anybody to replace 40 odd ministers and junior ministers in the government. So I think the way ahead, just by Johnson insisting on going ahead, has been closed off. If he refuses to go following the meeting taking place now in Number 10 Downing Street, then this 1922 committee has the power to force him to go, simply to vote, and his game is over. And I think that is what's likely to happen.
It can do that.
It can do that, yes.
That they can vote for Johnson to be force him to resign or take that position away from him?
Absolutely. As soon as they call a vote of confidence and Johnson loses that vote, then he's gone.
Once that vote of confidence is called, when will that happen? I mean, they're going to vote on it to happen, but, I mean, what length of time?
It could happen very quickly. It's within the gift of the 1922 committee to set the rules. They have, and it's not expected to be used very often, but in this critical situation, they will be trying to prevent a situation where Johnson creates a constitutional crisis. They can call a vote, and then he loses the vote, and then he goes.
Very well. Let me bring in Shabir Rizvi here. Shabir Rizvi, let's get down to business here, because that is what is at stake. I mean, we're looking at the UK economy. We're looking at, obviously, the cost of living crisis, inflation, and the whole host of other challenges, to say the least, and economic crises that the UK is facing. Not that other European countries are not facing. I mean, you need to have a team to handle that. And these are the most extreme circumstances that we're looking at. Forget about the fact that you came out of COVID and you're trying to deal with that, which now you have, obviously, the Ukraine conflict compounding that. How can this happen? How can a team be formed, let alone a leader, to be elected, were Johnson to go, to handle all this?
Well, look, this is the sort of a crucial question that I think the majority of the Conservative members of Parliament are weighing up, that even if a new leader comes in, will he be able to manage all the crises that we are facing that you have quite eloquently listed? The reality is that we have a broken political system here in UK, it appears. And this is becoming very clear with many crises that are on the horizon, which are being faced by the ordinary people. People blame the economic crisis on what's happening with Ukraine and Russia. But the reality is that we've had austerity for the last 12 years, since the last financial crisis back in 2008-2009. That austerity measures which have been applied really by the Conservatives, they've been in power for the whole of that period. So they can't shy away and say that, you know, it's the Labour baggage that has inflicted pain on the society and on the economy. Okay. It's the Conservative policy.
Let me jump in. I'm sorry to get McNapier a final answer here. If you can, under a minute, please, McNapier. To do the honourable thing, to put the interests of the nation before his own interests, is what the MPs are saying. Do you think that Prime Minister Johnson should resign?
Look, everybody, even his friends, know that honourable and Boris Johnson do not go together. The language that his Conservative Party members are using to describe him is very strong. He's a scoundrel. He's a rascal. He's a liar. And they voted for him because he gave them an 80-seat majority. He managed to sell Brexit and get a huge parliamentary majority.
Okay.
But now he's turned into a fantastic liability. And in terms of confronting the situation of real war, of real massive strikes by railway workers and health workers and teachers, he is not the man to lead the Tory
Very
party.
Well.
They
I got to
know
jump in
that.
Fresh out of time. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Went by so quick. Mick Napier, activist and commentator from Edinburgh. Thank you. And Shabir Rizvi, economic analyst from London. Good luck to you all, since you're all in the UK. Thank you so much for your input, both of you. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. In certain cases, we acted well and made achievements, and in certain cases, we showed negligence and laziness and weakness, and we naturally fell behind. This cannot be denied in any way. The school of thought, the plan and the path are correct. The path must be treaded correctly. We progressed, but in whichever area we showed laziness and negligence, we fell behind. There are many examples in the course of these days, both during the time of Imam and after the demise until today. Of course, the role of the enemy's enmity must not be overlooked. The extensive camp of the enemy entered the field against the revolution from the beginning of the revolution. some people think that we force the enemies into enmity. No. The Islamic Republic, which is by nature opposed to oppression, naturally makes oppressors show enmity. Do you not say that you are opposed to arrogance and oppression? Well, everyone who is arrogant and oppressive and every government that has these unfavorable characteristics shows enmity towards you. This is the Islamic Republic.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You say that you advocate spirituality. So everyone who is hostile towards the spirituality of the people will show opposition to you. The Islamic Republic says that it is opposed to vices. Therefore, those who have gotten used to vices and who cannot separate themselves from them will naturally show opposition to the Islamic Republic. This is something natural. The camp of the enemy of the enmities must not be overlooked. Of course, these enmities have taken on different forms. In the days leading to the victory of the revolution, the Americans sent their general Robert Heuser to Tehran in order to launch a coup. Of course, he thankfully returned frustrated and disappointed. On many other matters too, the Americans and the enemies were rendered frustrated and disappointed. Imam's endeavor to bring about a serious separation from Westerners would have naturally created some enemies because he would not allow them to interfere. He took the current Palestinian embassy, which was in the hands of the usurping Zionist regime at that time, away from the Zionists and handed it over to the Palestinians, who are the owners of Palestine.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.